Thank you, Herbie. Good morning. My name is Paul, and I thoroughly enjoy being an alcoholic. I enjoy it since you found me and sobered me up and cleaned me up and convinced me that you'll keep me sober another 20 years as long as I keep doing the things, helping you do the things you're doing. And God almighty, I used to think it would be difficult to stay sober. Can you think of anything easier than staying sober this last weekend? I mean, isn't this a beautiful day and a beautiful way to stay sober? Have you had a good time? If you haven't enjoyed yourself, you know who to blame, don't you? Yeah. It's your own damn fault. I thought it was terrific. In fact, one of the things I enjoy about it, this is a home stretch, and it's been such a great weekend. There's surely nothing I can do to screw it up too bad now. Of course, it could have gone along very well without Max telling that perverted version of my story this morning. Okay. You shouldn't. But yeah, somebody says that she was telling my story, and that's what I was thinking. But I guess somebody said an alcoholic was a person who's obsessed with alcohol, and a pre-Al-Anon is somebody who is obsessed with an alcoholic. So I guess we talk about our obsessions, and they talk about how they are affected by what we do. But it was the last night I noticed, too, that Phil was making fun of the Al-Anons, and people were laughing at the Al-Anons. And I don't think we should do that. I don't really think we should laugh at the Al-Anon. So. Well, thank you, Al-Anons. I knew there were some Al-Anons here. I can feel the vibrations. But you shouldn't. But no, you shouldn't laugh. You should not laugh at the Al-Anon. So. No, you really shouldn't now. Our book speaks very kindly of them. It says, they're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. You shouldn't laugh now. I mean, you really shouldn't laugh. As a matter of fact, some of you should look into that Al-Anon program. I understand it. I've been talking to people over the weekend, and there are a few people around that have a little trouble making our program. Now, this Al-Anon program, it has all of our steps. Did you notice? They have all our steps. They have our traditions. They've stolen some of our slogans. Sometimes they even read some of the book. And they have our whole program. They've got the whole thing. And they can drink, too. Okay. Now, it might be just what some of you are looking for. It's true that we get some of our best customers from Al-Anon. And if we really got them fooled, we have them convinced that when they come to AA, it's a step up. If you're new in AA, you realize you are already at the bottom of the social ladder. Any place you go from AA is up, but it's not up to from Al-Anon. And as a matter of fact, if you really want to insult an alcoholic who's really going crazy in a relationship with another alcoholic, you suggest that they go to Al-Anon. Me go to Al-Anon? I'd rather go crazy. Anyway, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad you're all here. It'd sure be dull if you weren't here. I said I was glad to be. I haven't always been glad to be an alcoholic. As a matter of fact, I haven't even always been an alcoholic. God, I wouldn't want you to think that. In fact, I certainly wasn't an alcoholic when I was going to say came here. I didn't came here. I was sent here. I wasn't even sent here. It was just that this was the only place I could come to get a pass to get off the nut ward. I was on the nut ward, the hospital I was on the staff of. And it's a very boring place to be. I mean, in fact, I didn't know how to act on the nut ward. I knew how to act if I had a stethoscope and as acting as a doctor, they teach you that in medical school. But they don't teach you in medical school how to act on a network when you're on the wrong end of the stethoscope. But it was very boring. I went around and I tried to help the other patients. Some of them acted like they didn't even want any help. But it's a very boring place. You have a hard time finding things to do. They had a weird theory there. They had a strange theory on that nut ward. They tried to convince me that the quality of my life would be improved if I learned how to make leather belts. Yeah? That made no sense to me at all. I don't know how my life would be improved in any way if I learned how to make leather belts. I didn't understand the theory. And besides, I didn't understand the instructions. But that was not my fault. I've always known that if you don't understand a thing well enough that you can explain it to me so that I understand it, then you don't really understand it all that well. And that stupid occupational therapist had already explained it to me 3 times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a 4th time. And that was a strange thing, too. I went to this AA meetings just to get off the network, and I've been to every AA function I can think of since. I love to go to AA functions, roundups, conferences, conventions, even social events, anything. And yet, I've never been to one yet where they had an occupational therapy booth. Yeah. And yet, for some reason or other, I went to a few of these AA meetings, and I went back to that nut ward, and I made the most beautiful pair of moccasins you've ever seen. Pair of moccasins and a half a wallet. My moccasins were terrific. They were good moccasins. They really looked good, and the workmanship was terrific, and they felt good, and they wore good. I used to wear them every chance I got. And when the tongs would break, I'd repair them and patch them up. And lasted 7 years, I was able to wear those moccasins every chance I got. And when they wore out, I felt bad. Not bad enough to go back and make another pair, but I did enjoy those moccasins. As a matter of fact, Max apparently was concerned about my maybe going back and getting another pair. Because for my 7th AA birthday, she had my moccasins bronzed. And I love my bronze moccasins. I just think they're terrific. As long as I remember where they came from, I won't have to go back and make another pair. I just love them. Even though they're not nearly as comfortable anymore. But as I say, I wasn't an alcoholic when I started going to these meetings, and I didn't become an alcoholic till I'd been coming to these meetings for 7 months. That's where you get alcoholism. You get it in meetings like this. It's a contagious disease. You know, people think you get it by what you put in your mouth. No, it's by what you let go in your ears. And if you're here today and you're not really, really, really an alcoholic, be real careful what you listen to. It's a contagious thing, so we pick it up in places like that. That's why I always identify all the alcoholics. They always say, "Oh, please raise your hand," you know. And you can't speak unless you identify yourself as an alcoholic. That's so that if somebody gets the disease, they can't blame you and say they weren't warned. You know, in fact, this is the alcoholics are. In fact, you go down to the local bar, one of these places, walk in, say, "I'm running a survey. Will all the alcoholics please raise their hand?" You won't get the same response there as you get. In fact, they won't even think you're very damn funny. There aren't any alcoholics in the bars. Alcoholics are all in meetings. They spend Sunday morning at meetings. And that's just, this is where I got my disease. I came to one meeting too many. I wasn't an alcoholic at all when I came here. And after 7 months, I was just alcoholic enough to stay. And I've become more alcoholic since. I think I'm a lot more alcoholic today. In fact, everything I see with all the research workers, God bless the AA research workers. They keep testing the waters out there, see if it's any safer to drink now than it was when I came in. And from what I see, I'm more alcoholic now and more allergic to alcohol now than I was when I quit drinking. And I don't intend to test that theory. I'm just willing to let them test it and watch what happens. I've never seen one of them yet come back and say that they'd found anything better, that alcohol is working on them any better than it was. I always did feel that I reacted abnormally or unusually to the drug alcohol. And that's not difficult for me to conceive of. I've been around medicine since I was 4 years old, and every medicine I know. I grew up in a drugstore, and then I ended up in medical school. I ended up as a pharmacist first, and I didn't like being a pharmacist. People didn't seem to think that was such a big deal. People weren't very impressed with me having a pharmacy degree, and I thought they'd be more impressed if I had a medical degree, but it was depression, and my family didn't want me to be a doctor. They wanted to stay home and work in the family drugstore, so there was no money or funds for me to become a doctor. So my answer to that problem was to marry the girl next door and suggest she work my way through medical school. And she did, and I did, and I got a doctor, but people weren't very impressed with that either. And I thought they'd be more impressed if I had a specialty degree. So I said to her, "You're doing a good job, kid. You keep on working, and we'll get us a specialty degree." And she did, and I did, and I specialized in internal medicine. That's where you treat the medical problems of adults. You don't do any surgery, can't stand the sight of blood. You know, don't treat any kids. Can't stand kids, for God's sake. You know. You just treat adults. And that's all adults want when they come to you. They want two things. They want a label. They want to know, "What's wrong with me, doc?" You know, give them a name. "You got Icarus to the biggest." "Oh, I got Icarus to the biggest. Thank you. Now, what are you going to give me for it?" They want the other thing. They want a label and they want a pill. A label and a prescription. And that was my specialty. I was good at that. I could, no matter what was wrong with you, I could give it a name. Then I had a pill for it. I had a pill for every ill. And it happened that I was sick a lot. And Max and I built up a real big practice, a very ethical practice. He even had my own version of the Hippocratic Oath in that I never ever gave a patient a pill that I hadn't first tried out on myself. Well, from the way you laugh, it would sound like you thought I abused them, and I just... I never abused any pills. And in fact, you ask any doctor how the patient got hooked on his pills, and it'll always be the same. He'll always tell you the same. They abused their pills. They abused them. I never abused any. In fact, I don't even know how you abuse pills. You throw them against the wall, snap them on and beat them up. You know. I know how to physical abuse and verbal abuse, but I never abused any pills. In fact, I had my own little pill pocket. I had a little pocket that I carried the pills in. You have to be very careful where you carry your pills. You know. Can't carry them in with your change. Somebody say, "You got change for your quarter?" You say, "Oh, yeah, here you go." And you go, like, "Oh, you're carrying Nimbitol around your hand." Or you put them over in this pocket and you go to get the keys to get in your car and you go like that and you throw, "Oh, you throw the Quaalude running down the hall." You know. Now you put them in your shirt pocket when you're not wearing a sweater, and then you see the Tylenols right through the shirt. You know? Or you bend over and they fall out. So you keep them in this little pill pocket. And so I treated my pills with respect. You know? never abused them, and never, they were just tiny little pills. And I never abused them. I never became a pill head. Pill heads take pills to get high or to get loaded or something. I like to taste them or something. I don't know. I never did that. I never ever took a pill unless I had the symptom that only that pill would relieve. I had the symptom. It was, I either had it or I could feel it coming on. And it was that's true. Every pill I ever took was medically indicated at the time and taken according to directions and prescribed by a doctor. And dispensed by a pharmacist. I bought my pills, like Max, I bought my pills by the thousand. Can you imagine that woman buying a thousand Librium and taking one a day? Why would anybody take one a day? That's like somebody that had one drink, for God's sake. You can tell she's weird. But I shouldn't talk that way. Max is fine. He's terrific. As a matter of fact, less than a month. Second of next month. Max and I will celebrate our... I don't know how we'll celebrate, but we will have our 48th wedding anniversary. actually, we will have been emotionally involved to very varying degrees of intensity. We will have been involved with each other for over 60 years. And who is right, you know. Yeah. Matter of fact, as I've often said, the young people today, they just don't have what it takes to put together a relationship like that. Young people today don't have what it takes to
put together that kind of relation. They don't have it.
For one thing, you've got to be very, very old. And you, it's kind of like my friend Angie says, there's only two rules to becoming an old-timer in AA. Only two rules. Don't drink, don't die. You know? So, if you hang in there, maybe you can make it. I started to say something about reacting to drugs peculiarly. And all drugs are like that way. Every drug's the same. All drugs are the same. Everybody reacts to them exactly the same as everybody else, except for the people that react differently. Everybody can take aspirin, except people that can't. Anybody can take penicillin, except people that are allergic to it. Used to be you give penicillin by shot, you know. And give somebody a shot of penicillin, turn around, lay the syringe down, and they drop dead. Wow, he sure is sensitive to that stuff. Weak-willed son of a bitch, isn't he? Yeah. Wouldn't you think if he couldn't handle it any better than that, they'd just leave it alone, you know? All drugs are like that. And that's the way I am with alcohol. I would drink alcohol. Of course I drank alcohol. Everybody drinks alcohol. This country, this is a drinking society. Everybody drinks. You have to drink. You couldn't be invited any place if you didn't drink. Nobody'd want you. What'd they call your wedding for? That's why you have you come and celebrate and things like that. And you have to drink. Except sometimes when I drank, I would end up getting accidentally drunk. And the other time, I used to drink to go to church dinner dances. I hate church dinner dances. I hate church. A lot of people are. You have to talk to me. I don't know how to talk to people. And you have to dance. You can't not dance at a church dinner dance. We can't just sit there because there's always some hyperactive woman comes running up to you and says, "Come on, Paul, let's dance." I go, "Oh, I don't dance." I say, "Oh, sure you do. Drag you out on the floor, you know, and prove that you don't dance." You know, yeah. You can't not dance. And I used to have a few drinks before I'd go. It relaxed me physically, and I could dance. Dance good. Relaxed me mentally, and I could talk to people. But it seems like as time went by, the two got out of sync. And I would maybe not even have begun to relax mentally yet, and I'd get too relaxed physically. It would be, it would affect my tongue or my mouth or something, and my speech, and I would talk very slowly and deliberately so nobody would notice. Or I would trip and stumble, or I would trip when there was nothing to... I would find myself lying there on the floor. Right, lying on the floor. And my brain would say, "Get up, you fool. People will think you're drunk." And my body would say, "What do you mean, get up? We're paralyzed from the ears down." And I'd lie there and think, "Isn't that strange that I'm paralyzed? I can't move. Isn't that odd that we can't move here?" And I thought, "Isn't that odd that alcohol affects us that way?" You know? And I'd lay there and mentally, I would leaf through the pages of Goodman and Gilman's textbook of pharmacology under ethanolism, looking for toxicology of ethanol and effects of. And I never could find paralysis from the ears down. And I thought, "Someday I'm going to have to ask somebody about that, you know, why I react so peculiarly to this drug." I never found anybody to ask. You don't ask questions like that because they're liable to tell you real impractical things. Like, "Well, if it makes you paralyzed, don't drink it," you know. And I didn't want that kind of an answer, but I'd lie there and think about it and try to figure out why I react so peculiarly. In fact, it was kind of, being of a scientific bent, it was kind of interesting. It gave me something to think about, take my mind off my full bladder. I always... It's a bad combination. Whenever I was paralyzed from the ears down, I always had a full bladder. Yeah. Bladder that absolutely refused to remain full. And it was not a practical combination. And somebody asked me this morning, was I going to talk about my dog? I said, what about my dog? She says, the one that used to come home from the veterinarian with a message that all he needed was more love. And I remember that Max was going to the psychiatrist, my kids were going to clinical psychologist. It was all kind of classy and modern and happy. You're supposed to do that if you're really interested in your family, take good care of them. That was fine, but it really hurt my feelings that this dumb cat and dog doctor would think I had a neurotic dog. And I remember telling her, I said, you tell that idiot cat and dog doctor he's no psychiatrist. All I want to know is, why does the dog wet in my pants when I'm holding it? Strangely enough, that dog hasn't wet my pants since I joined AA. You know? And neither have I. And that's it. We're both getting better. And the other thing about this drinking, sometimes I would have relaxed physically. I wouldn't have even begun to relax physically, and I'd get too relaxed mentally. It's as if alcohol was the solvent that dissolved all the adhesiveness that held all my brain cells together. And my mind, morally and emotionally, just went, and I fell apart. And I would be like I would be drinking, and my brain cells would all get together and they'd say, oh, what the hell, he's drinking anyhow, let's take the night off. And they'd go on home, go to bed. You know? And my body would go on doing things. You know? And in the morning I'd try to figure out what my body had been doing when my brain was home in bed. And I never did figure out how to recall things that weren't recorded at the time that they happened. Seems in retrospect that the longer I drank, the harder it was for me to predict what was going to happen when I drank. But that didn't keep me from drinking. I turned my will and my life over to the care of alcohol day after day. And alcohol and pills and drugs. But every time, way back in pharmacy school, I found out I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a sleeping problem. I found out that I couldn't sleep at night. It was just critical that I sleep at night. Something horrible would happen if I laid there awake at night. I'd go to school all day, work the family drugstore all the evening, study till midnight, 1, 2 o'clock, go to bed. I'd lay there and I'd be half awake and half asleep, and in the morning I'd be both tired and stupid. And I found out that I could drink a couple of beers at the end of the study period, jump in bed, sleep real fast, and wake up smart. And I got honor grades in pharmacy school and honor grades in medical school and did all these things. So, but the moment I couldn't use sleeping pills because they didn't work till the next day. But a couple of beers just worked fine. But I didn't realize that when I drank in order to get to sleep, I was now using a chemical in order to solve a living problem. That's not social drinking when you're using alcohol to solve a living problem. And it's better living through chemistry. That's what it is. And I found that through the years, every time I used a chemical to solve a living problem, it worked. The only problem was that as it worked for a shorter and shorter period of time and had to be repeated, or it took more and more of it to get the same effect. And also, it had a side effect, which meant that I had to take some other chemical to counteract the side effect of the one I was taking, so that my disease was progressive in all three of those categories. And that's why I had to switch to other pills. I remember the more I took in order to sleep at night, the harder it was to get up in the morning. So finally, I had to take pep pills to get up in the morning. And I'm very indebted to pep pills, appetite appeasers, we call them. And I started with and had the upper and a downer in it. And one day I said to myself, why are you taking a pill with a downer in it when you're trying to get upper? So I left the downer out, was taking straight amphetamines. And I'm very indebted to them because I don't know that I would have had the stamina to stay out there and complete all of my pre-AA training period if it hadn't been for the pep pills. And they worked fine. They did affect my hearing, and that sometimes I couldn't listen fast enough to hear what I was saying, but I would find myself saying something, and I think to myself, what the hell are you saying that again for? You've already said it three times. I don't know, it just sounds so good, I think I'll say it again, blah, 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 you know. I don't talk about it anymore because the women's lib people got after me, but it's a true story, and anything I say in AA is true as I remember it. Anytime my life reaches a point where I have to make up stories to tell in AA, it'd be something. But I remember I used to do a lot of physical examinations, and when I examine men, I have them take off everything but their shorts. When I examine women, I have them take off everything. And I give them a little sheet with two holes, and they stick their arms through it, and the sheet hangs down in front of them. They feel like they got something on. And they're sitting at the table facing this way, and I'm standing on this side, and I examine their eyes, ears, nose, throat. I take a little plastic ring, I drop it down, and I immediately put my right hand over the left breast, and I say to them, always say the same thing. I always say, do you examine your breasts regularly for lumps? One of two things happen. They either think to themselves, my last doctor told me to do that, and I used to do that, but I never found any lumps, so I decided I wasn't doing it right, so I stopped doing it, but I ought to be doing that. Or else they think, my last doctor told me to do that, but I don't want any lumps in my breast, so I've never done that, but I ought to be doing it. But either way, they're thinking of the scientific aspect of why some man is standing there with his hands on their breast. So I just never put my hands on a woman's breast without saying, do you examine your breasts regularly for lumps? And it's always worked very well for me. Except this one day I went to work and I wasn't feeling at all well that morning. As I recall, I had the flu again, and I took some extra pep pills, and I was examining this gal who was rather small. It wasn't that she was short, small. It's just she was small. She wasn't well endowed in the breast department. And I examined her eyes, ears, nose, throat, neck, took a little plastic thing, dropped down, put my right hand over her left nubbin, and I looked at her very solicitously, and I said, do you examine your lumps regularly for breasts? I've often wondered whatever happened to her. I have the feeling I'm going to meet her in AA someday. Yeah. So I ended up in the nut ward. And from there I went to some of those A&A meetings. And I thought I'd go to enough of them to get the passes or to get out of get enough brownie points to get out of the nut ward. Because happiness on the nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. You do almost anything. They have a certain element of control over you. And I did win my discharge button and got out. I had no intention of going back to the thing. But as Max was saying this morning, she liked the meetings. And once I found out she liked them, then I could use that against her. Because whenever she acted smart, then I would decide I wasn't going to go to the meeting anymore on Saturday night. And I don't know if you've ever tried. She went off. She did something she couldn't do. She got in the car and drove down to Laguna Beach from Anaheim on the freeways and all that stuff, which she couldn't do. But I don't know if you ever tried that, staying home on Saturday night drinking while your non-alcoholic wife is off laughing it up at the AA meeting. You know, I found it kind of boring, and I'm the one who, when I had the convulsion and she took me to the hospital, I wouldn't stay unless she stayed in the bed next to me. Can you picture that? This big shot doctor as a patient in the hospital he's on the staff of, and he won't stay overnight unless his mommy wife stays with him. So very independent, but very dependent. And so I went back to the meetings just to be with her. In 7 months, I turned into an alcoholic. And there were a lot of things that happened that caused that. One was that I heard somebody say they said of themselves, they said, I was judging me by my intentions, and the world was judging me by my actions. And I was sorry they said that, because I am one of the best-intentioned people you'll ever meet. But if I looked at just my actions, I didn't like what I saw. And it was about that time that it's very important, I think, it was right about that time that somebody said, blurted it right out. They said, I'd rather be an AA by mistake than out there by mistake. And that has affected my program to this day. Because at that time I was making lists of things that you had done that I hadn't done, that I thought once the list was long enough would somehow prove that indeed you were alcoholic, but certainly I wasn't. You couldn't not do all those things that you've done and still be alcoholic. And I was also making a list of things that were wrong with AA, because I realized that once you knew I didn't belong here, you'd ask me what I thought of it as I was leaving it. As a matter of fact, I still have both lists. I don't know even where they are. Nobody's asking for them. But I'm really impressed. You know, this is a disease, and I'm fascinated by what this disease does to those of us who are allergic to alcohol. I'm fascinated by drunkologues. I'm just fascinated by what alcohol does. not only to us who have the allergy, but those who love those of us who have the allergy. I enjoy not only the drunkologues, but the alanomalogues. And the anything more fascinating than what alcohol does to us, what's even more fascinating is the recovery. Recovery. It's the only disease I know wherein when we get well, we're weller than we were before we got sick. We get weller than well. It's fascinating. I keep coming back to these meetings just to hear the stories of what's going on. Even the one keeping me sober just because it's fascinating what happens. It's just the most fascinating disease I've ever studied. And I thoroughly enjoy it. I enjoy being sober and I enjoy being a part of this program. I enjoy what's going on here. In fact, I was reading some of the AA history. And I find that fascinating. That, as a matter of fact, when I was in the Nut Ward, I was in the Rush Center. Now, they don't call it the Rush Center because people are rushing to get in. They call it the Rush Center after Benjamin Rush. Benjamin Rush was a psychiatrist, a very, very prominent psychiatrist. He was like the Surgeon General of the United States in the time of General Washington. So you know when he lived. In fact, he was one of three doctors who signed the Declaration of Independence. So he was back then. He was a big shot. And in his time, he wrote a treatise, a 28-page treatise on alcoholism as a disease, and was telling the doctors of that time that they should recognize this disease and they should treat it and they should do the things to help prevent it. And just a month ago, I was able to get a copy of his treatise. And one of the last things that he suggested was the way to prevent it is that ingestion of alcohol should be stopped totally and permanently. It's one of the things we say all along, and but we do it a day at a time. But anyway, that has nothing to do with it, except that Dr. Silkworth, who was the doctor for Bill Wilson, was also believed that alcoholism was the disease. And indeed, we might not even be meeting here today if Silkworth hadn't been able to convince Bill Wilson that it was a disease that he had rather than a moral issue, a matter of intellect or willpower. And so it's a medical problem. And it was Ebbie and the Oxford movement that Ebbie and Bill Wilson both belonged to that they came to realize that it was a spiritual recovery. We have a medical problem with a spiritual recovery. Two factors. It's a medical problem with a spiritual recovery. And it was Bill Wilson who added the third element. He thought it's a medical problem, a spiritual recovery. Maybe if I give it away, we can both keep it. Because that was a part of the Oxford movement, to go out and convince other people. So he took his idea of it being a medical problem, a spiritual answer, and I'll give it away to other alcoholics. We'll both stay sober. He ran around finding drunks and telling them about his spiritual recovery. I understand there were 70-some. None of them stayed sober. Wasn't working. He was disappointed. He was complaining to his wife, Lois. His idea didn't work. And none of them was staying sober. She said something to the effect, well, it is working, stupid. You're sober. And he said, oh. And he was about to leave for Akron. He was about to go to Akron. He was complaining to Dr. Silkworth that nothing wasn't working, his idea. And Silkworth said, don't stress the spiritual recovery as the first thing. Stress the medical problem first, that it is a disease. It's a medical problem. Then the spiritual answer. See if that works. He says, I'll try it. He went to Akron. First drunk he tried it on, it worked. And AA was born. And it turned out that first drunk that he talked to that worked with was a physician. And God, in his infinite sense of humor, saw that that physician was a proctologist, a specialist in rectal pain. And we might not be here today if that hadn't been the case, you know. And I find that, and you know, that idea of giving it away to keep it is essentially the whole thing, it seems to me. It's a very loving thing to give it away. It's a very loving thing to just listen to somebody giving it away. You're doing it now, just sitting and listening. Sitting and listening. That's a very loving thing to do. And it really doesn't matter what the speaker is saying or how it's going. You sit there and listen. Listen, yeah. Doesn't matter. I've seen you do it. I know you just sit there and listen. Yeah. It's a very loving thing. And by you sitting there and listening, and I talk, it helps. I'm trying to help you stay sober, and you're helping me stay sober. Everybody got up and walked out. We don't walk out on people that are talking, no matter what they're saying. Because if you did that, the person that's talking might end up getting drunk. And we want them to stay sober, so we listen. And that communication seems to be the basis. Max and I have been kind of making a hobby of learning more and more about how to communicate. It's not only communicating with people in AA, and communicating with people out there, communicating with each other, and communicating with my higher power. And it seems to be the whole... I have a theory. Actually, it's not a theory. I happen to know what makes an alcoholic an alcoholic. But I don't tell people about it because I don't want them to argue with me. My mind is made up. I don't want to know any facts, you know. It's called the pathophysiology of a disease. What causes the disease? What makes an alcoholic? Well, let me tell you. Don't tell anybody else, but I'll tell you. An alcoholic is a person who has a tremendous capacity to generate love and an incapacity to express love. So the alcoholic generates this love, and it builds up as a pressure, and it can't be expressed. It's like pressure in a tea kettle. It just keeps building up and building up, and it can't be relieved. Chemicals. Alcohol is poured in, and it seems to relieve the pressure, but it doesn't. It only gives the impression of it helping. It's actually making it worse. It worsens the communication problem, and the love can't be expressed. And the pressure builds up, and it gets worse and worse. And even the people, they can't give love, they can't receive love. So that the people that love us can't express their love for us. And they begin to get screwed up. They can't express their love either. And the pressure then builds up in them. And as the pressure gets worse, it comes out, not as love, but as hostility, anger, frustration, resentment, all the negative emotions, even violence. There's no answer to that. There's no answer to that. A person needs to express love and can't. What happens? Through no good judgment on their own, they end up in AA. And in AA, what do we do with a newcomer? We love the hell out of them. We just love the hell out of them. We take them in. We don't care who they are, where they've been, what they've done, what they haven't done. We just love them. We don't care if they want to be loved or not. We just love them anyhow. You know? And what happens? They start acting loving. They start getting somebody else a cup of coffee. They smile at somebody across the room. They shake hands with them. They remember somebody's name. And that makes them feel. They do these things that are acts of love that aren't even recognized as acts of love. And the word love isn't even mentioned. And it ends up, the newcomer, in a matter of days, weeks, months, they're sober. And they don't even know why. But they've been acting loving. And then it's in there. We literally love the hell out of other hellish lives. And to me, that's the way AA works. And this idea of communicating is that Max was talking about it this morning. It's a very loving thing to try to communicate with the person you're living with. Or the people in your own home. It's fun to try to treat the people in our home the way AA treats newcomers. Wouldn't it be great if we could treat everybody we meet throughout our lives as newcomers, the way AA treats newcomers? And I even try to do loving things. I remember a woman in our morning meeting said that she wanted to be more loving, so she asked her sponsor how she could be more loving. And her sponsor says, don't try to be more loving. She says, don't try to do loving things. She says, stop doing something unloving. Well, she always hated to... She's always yelling at her kids. Always yelling at her kids. She yelled at her kids the most when she picked up the papers, morning papers, scattered all over the house. She picked it up. She always yelling at the kids. She made up her mind. From now on, she wasn't going to yell at the kids when she picked up papers. Yell at them all the rest of the time, but she wasn't going to yell at them when she picked up papers. She got in the habit of picking up papers, not yelling at the kids while she's picking them up, and she felt so good about it, she was looking for other things she could do and not yell at the kids. And so I find it just looking for little things. between little things that are seem lovely. For instance, like Max likes to wake up to a hot cup of coffee. Getting Max a cup of coffee in the morning. Let me say this. Chuck C. always used to say that love was doing things for free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. I thought that was kind of stupid. Because I always knew that marriage, for instance, was a 50-50 proposition. Now, that was one of the dumbest things I ever learned in my life, that marriage is a 50-50 proposition. Because I spent all my life checking the balance to see what was happening. A lot of times I wouldn't put something loving on the balance, and I couldn't because Max hadn't put anything on for a long time. You know, finally I'd put something on the balance, and I couldn't put anything more on until I see what she was going to put on. Might be a long time. Finally she'd put something on. And was that 50%? I don't think that was 50%. I'd take some of mine off, you know. Love's not a 50-50 proposition. Marriage isn't a 50-50. Love is a 100%. 100%. You do it for free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. Even if you expect them to appreciate it, then it's not love. It's barter. You're expecting, I'll do this for you if you appreciate it, and then later on you do something for me. And I was saying that Max likes to wake up to a hot cup of coffee. Truth is, she doesn't like to wake up at all. She hates to wake up. When she does wake up, she likes to look over to the left and see a cup of coffee on her bedside table. She doesn't like hot coffee, and she doesn't like cold hot coffee. She likes a cup of hot coffee with 3 ice cubes in it. And she likes to be able to see the ice cubes in it. If the ice cubes have melted, it starts her day off with a problem right there. You know, so. He said, "You put the ice cubes in this coffee." You know. See the ice cubes in the thing. I get up before Max. I always get up before Max, and I don't know where she stores all the sleep she gets. But I get up before Max, and I go and I take care of the dogs. And one of the things I do in most mornings, I sit down on my computer. I do a lot of automatic writing. Automatic writing. I used to do it pen and pencil, and then I got to do it. I taught myself to type, and I love to type. I just love to see the words coming out on the typewriter. I've graduated since to a computer. And I type a letter to God. I say, "Dear God, here we go again. Let's see what you can do with this one. You've been doing a pretty good job. Just keep on doing what you're doing. Be sure you have a real good day, because I think if you have a good day, I'll probably have a good day. So let's keep going." And I just type as fast as I can, and not stopping to correct anything. For God's sake, don't stop and read it. Just keep going. Type as fast as you can. And it's interesting, the answers, the intuitive answers, the decisions, the things I need to know that come to my mind as I'm typing this stuff to God. It's one of them in that sense, in talking to God. And those intuitive answers come. And at the end, I get through, and I decide it's time to get Max's coffee. And I will say to the computer, "I want to quit." And the computer says, "Fine. You want to save this, yes or no?" And I say no, and poof, it's gone. It goes where all 5 steps go. You know, it's just gone. And then I decide it's time to go get Max her coffee, and I go get a cup. She has a particular kind of cup she likes, and I get it. She doesn't like brewed coffee. She likes instant coffee. She likes any instant coffee as long as it's Yuban. And she likes just a level teaspoonful of Yuban coffee. And she doesn't like cream. Oh, she hates milk. She likes powdered cream, likes lots of that. 2 heaping teaspoons full of cream or a level teaspoon full of Yuban. And you fill a cup with hot water. You don't boil the water. You get the hot water out of the hot water dispenser. Hot water dispenser is a thing that has a tank under the sink, and there's a faucet, and it dispenses water at just the right temperature for putting the 3 ice cubes in it. And you have to have a man come in and install it. You have to drill a hole in the stainless steel sink that replaced the perfectly good white porcelain sink that was there. And you fill it with hot water, and you take it in the bedroom, and you be careful and then you put the ice cubes in it. And then you be careful walking in the darkened bedroom. You don't step on her shoes or anything that's on the floor. And you get to the side of the bed, and you go to the bedside stand. You don't look for a bare spot. You just look for a level spot. And you set the coffee down, and you sneak out of the room, and don't wake her, for God's sake, and hope that she wakes up before the ice cubes melt. Now, sometimes we've been up late the night before coming back from a meeting or something like that, and you think she might sleep a little later. Sometimes you can put the ice cubes in a little cheese glass they used to drink out, and you set that beside the cup. And then when she wakes up, if she sees the ice cubes sitting there and they're not melted, and she will pour them in herself. She doesn't mind doing that once in a while. Now that's the easy part. The hard part is you have to not expect her not to appreciate it. See, if you expect her to appreciate it, then that's not love, it's barter. And I have to admit right off, Max is very cooperative. She never appreciates it. Now that's true love, indeed. And what was it Phil said last night? He said something about if you get a soft chair, an easy chair, and you sit down and start thinking about your body, you'll feel an acre of pain. And I was thinking, think about your body. You don't have to think about anything. You just turn on your brain and start thinking. And you're going to start getting, I don't know how you are, but all I have to do to get in trouble is start thinking. I don't even have to have a problem. In fact, I can take any non-problem and get to thinking about it. I can look at that and I say, well, hell, that's no problem. But if you think about it a minute, it could be. And pretty soon I think, yeah, it is kind of a problem. Just look at it a minute. No, I'm thinking, really, look at this. It is a bit of a... Pretty soon I'm thinking, by God, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. Everybody else is missing it. People don't realize this really is a problem. And, it's hard for anybody to help you with a problem like that. They tell you real dumb things like, well, don't think about it. How are you going to not think about it? You look over there, and there it is. And you look over there, and there it is. You got this overwhelming problem. And it's hard to get rid of something like that. I find that problems are like a delicate plant. Something you've nurtured and you cared for. A lot of water, a lot of fertilizer. And problems are delicate. Have you ever had a problem that's such a work of art, such a beautiful thing, such a delicate thing, and you worked so hard on it, you can't even go to a meeting that night? Somebody says, you go in the meeting tonight and say, oh no, I've got to stay home and work on this problem. You go off to one of those dumb meetings, you're liable to forget and not get back in time. And that problem's liable to wilt to the point where you can't even bring it back, Problems have a very high infant mortality. You can't neglect them at all. You stay right in there with them and work with them. If you neglect them at all, the damn things just disappear. That's just awful. And you have to start all over again. I don't know how it is with you and your thinking, but when I think, it's somebody talking. Talk, 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 talk. Talk, 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 talk. When I was born, they held me up and they hit me on the back of the head. Talk, 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 talk. Like a radio talk show. Talk, talk, talk. Sometimes drift over and pick up another one. Talk, 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 talk. It's just all the time talk. In my head, I'm talking all the time. A lot of times you think, I'm not listening. When you're talking to me, it's true. It's not true. I'm listening, but I'm listening to all the people in my head. A whole lot of people there. Talk, 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 talk. Sometimes I go to a meeting, drink too much coffee. They really talk, 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 talk. I go home, want to go to bed. My body wants to lie down and go to sleep. My brain says, no, let's lay here and talk about it a while. Or even in the middle of the night, I'll be sound asleep and they'll say, hey, wake up, we want to talk to you. They'll say things like, that problem, that thing, the situation that you thought you handled so well today? Wasn't like that at all. They're really ticked off at you. Just wait till morning, And you've done the same thing other times. You've done a lot of dumb things, as a matter of fact. You don't want to write your fourth step, by God, we'll sit here and take it right tonight, So the night goes on like that. Talk, 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 talk. A lot of people live in my head. A lot of people live up there. It's really helped me to find that out and divide them. And I used to fight them. I used to drink and take drugs and have to shut them all up so I could sleep. And that hasn't worked at all well, because not only is do I have a lot of strange people up there, but that's also, it seems to me, that's where God is. He's in the center of all those people. He's in the center of calm, in the very center of me. And when I shut them off, it's the same as shutting you off. It's the same as no longer coming to meetings, because that's how God talks to me, either through the voices in my head, or the voice that gets through when I'm sitting at my computer, or the voices in AA. And I can't shut them off, and I can't shut you. I don't ever intend to quit coming to meetings. I'd be shutting God's voice off. It's interesting to listen. When is it God speaking to me in an AA meeting? Is it the old-timer? Is it the newcomer? Is it somebody in between? Is it before the meeting, after the meeting? Is somebody I took to the meeting? Somebody I took home? Or is it when I'm cleaning up in the kitchen? Or, you know, whatever. And the same with the voices in my head. I don't get mad at them anymore. I'm glad that you can't hear them. As I heard somebody talking about it at my home group last Wednesday night, and she says, it's a good thing I didn't have two loudspeakers on my head broadcasting all those voices in my head. It would have been tremendous if you'd have heard all the stuff that goes on. I'm glad that that's not that way, but I no longer get mad at whoever it is talking. Whatever they say, I say, well, thank you for participating. Now, if you'll sit down, we'll call on somebody else, you know. Everybody gets a chance to participate. So my relationship with the people in my head, relationship with the people outside my head is getting better. My relationship with myself is getting much, much better. I haven't tried to think of a heroic way to kill myself in a long time. And my relationship, as I say, with my higher power is better. And that's such a understatement to say my relationship with my higher power is better. I have a whole new higher power concept. And he and I have a tremendous relationship. He and I, we're friends today, whereas we used to hate each other's guts when I came into this program. And today, we're friends. And he and I get along fine. We play a game. We play a game. Somebody said that the only God is reality. And I thought, God, what an atheistic statement that is. And yet I've thought since, you know, that God creates reality. Reality is the manifestation of God. I haven't seen any burning bushes, but I've seen this place. Easy to see this is a manifestation of God. It's easy to see that you are a manifestation of God. So God, you know, the closest I can get to God is His reality. And He creates that reality. In fact, it says in the Bible, I think, I'm not much of a student of the Bible, it says that God created all this in, what was it, 6 days. And the seventh day He rested. To me it was implied, but not said, that on the eighth day He went back to work. He's been creating more reality ever since. He's been creating more worlds. It's my understanding this whole thing, this infinity is, and all that we see here, is expanding at the speed of light in all directions. More stars, more galaxies, more of all, everything. More people. My God, we don't know how we're going to feed them all. Apparently God, the Father, got, talk about a workaholic. He must know more of these, more of those, more of everything. He's just gone nuts making more of everything. That's why he had to have his son come along to help manage some of this stuff. You know? And he's just making more stuff. And he creates reality. He creates my day. Now what do? I create my attitude toward it. He creates the reality, and I create my attitude toward that reality. And between the two of us, we decide whether I'm going to have a good day or not. And he doesn't change the reality just because I object to it. Nothing's changed just because I don't like it. Nature asks me every moment of every day, what role do you want to play in your life today? You want to be victim? You want to be a hero? I was victim all my life before you found me. And today I can play a leadership role. I can play the hero role in my own life. I don't have to be the victim. Anytime I am the victim, I know that I've chosen that role. I've chosen that role. God and nature are not against me. They're for me. Everything is meant for us to enjoy. There's a line in the book that says that. As a matter of fact, I was looking online the other day, somebody pointed out to me, it said, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically and mentally. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically and mentally. Which means to me that all I have to do is get right with my higher power, get right with my God, and everything else will fall in place. And that seems to be pretty much what's happening for me. It's all falling in place. The line I was talking about, there's a lot of lines in the book. One that really fascinates me is the one that says, our past becomes our most prized possession. Isn't that weird? The thing I spent all my life trying to hide, keep hidden, becomes the only reason I'm standing here. If I didn't have that, I wouldn't even have been invited to be a part of what you're doing. I wouldn't belong in what you're doing. Our past becomes our most prized possession. The things I hated most about me are the things that have gotten me where I am today. And in fact, there's this business of God creating reality and then me having an attitude toward it. When I find fault with you, when I find fault with me, I'm complaining about God's handiwork. Even when I complain about my shortcomings, it's not up to me to root them out with willpower. It's up to God to take care of them. Up to me to be willing that He take care of them. Up to Him to do it. And if you don't like what you see, I know who you ought to go complain to, not me. You know? And I enjoy this program. I enjoy. Well, the line I started to talk about was there's another line I like is the one that says we absolutely. The line that says we cease fighting everything and everybody. Does it in two places. One of them in italics. I guess they wanted to stress it. We cease fighting everything and everybody. If I'm fighting anything or anybody, including myself today, I'm not working a good program. I'm not working a good program. The line I was talking about was on page 132, right in the middle. 16 lines above it, 16 lines below it, 2 words before it, 2 words after it, right in the middle, very middle. It says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Isn't that a strange sentence to have in a textbook on how to recover from a terminal illness? Never in any textbook I ever studied before I got here. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I find that that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to enjoy this life. And it seems to me that I don't have to be happy, happy, happy all the time. But if I'm not enjoying life, I'm not doing it right. If I'm not enjoying this program, I'm not doing it right. If I'm not enjoying my sobriety, I'm either not doing it long enough right, not doing it right. I have a great relationship with my higher power, and it's not His fault if I don't enjoy it, it's mine. In fact, my higher power is working so well for me these days, it's become kind of routine, and he's not nearly as busy. One of the things is I don't give him a list of things to do, and a list of things I want him to be sure and not let happen today. I kind of let him on his own. In fact, a lot of people say, I'll say this and I'm going to sit down. I'm going to force myself to sit down, so help me God. People say they don't know how to find God's will. I found a way that works real well for me. On a day-at-a-time program basis. In fact, that's the way I stay sober. I just don't drink today. I used to drink many yesterday, and I'm going to drink tomorrow, but I don't drink today. In fact, I wouldn't be able to not drink today if I didn't know I was going to drink tomorrow. But when tomorrow gets here, I'll check the time, and if it's today, I won't drink today. And the way I find God's will for me is I give Him a day. I tell Him in the morning, okay, God, here, you take this day. You just take this day. I'm not going to tell you anything to do with it. You're on your own. Do anything you want. You may come into my life today, whoever you want to come in. You have them say whatever you want them to say. You have them do whatever you want them to do. You have happen whatever you want to happen. You just take the whole day and do anything you want with it. And whatever happens, whatever people say, whatever they do, I'll know that's your will for me this day. And it scared the hell out of me the first time I did that. Yeah. And yet, whatever that day, and then if I don't work it out well that day, I start over and do it over differently the next day. And it's, this is the land of beginning again. If we don't like our life, we just start over. We just start over the next day, or we draw a line and start over right then, start a new day. The land of beginning again. We always relive our lives over right if we don't like the way it's been going. And if you don't have a higher power that you can work with like that, use mine. Use mine. He got a lot of free time now. he does. And you don't even have to ask me about it. Just go ahead and use him. Tell him I sent you. And if it doesn't work out, let me know about it. And I'll speak to him about it. But other than that, I won't. But I think the whole moral of the whole thing, I think, is we're supposed to enjoy sobriety. Sobriety was meant to be enjoyed. Life was meant to be enjoyed. And it just seems to me we should enjoy life whether we like it or not. Thank you all very much.
Wow.